if you would begin by introducing yourself and your organization.
I'm Karen Parker. I have a law degree. I have a specialized law degree in human rights and armed conflict law. My organizations are Humanitarian Law Project, which is based in Los Angeles. It has credentials at the United Nations. The other organization is Association of Humanitarian Lawyers, which I founded with several friends years ago, specifically to work on disability rights and war wounded.
Tell me about the petition that you have helped put together.
Actually, I did it. I did all the legal work. Others are doing a great deal of other work, but as far as the legal work, that's my work product, for better or for worse. When I saw the front page of the San Francisco Chronicle with a photograph of patients and doctors in a hospital face down with their hands tied behind their back and American soldiers with guns on them, I, of course, hit the roof. Most people looking at that photograph would think, oh, that's awful, but they wouldn't realize it was a war crime. Under armed conflict law, hospitals, hospital personnel, patients, movable medical units such as ambulance, etc., are absolutely off limits. When I read the article, the excuse given by the United States, or at least an explanation given by the United States, was that they considered it a field hospital of the insurgents. Well, it's still off limits, even if it's the field hospital of insurgents. So there's no excuse for it. I had prepared and submitted a similar petition against the United States for attacking a hospital for mentally retarded and mentally ill in Grenada. And I had filed that petition in the very same place the Organization of American States Inter-American Commission on Human Rights. So I thought, well, this is the only place we can go, and we might as well take this there because it's essentially the same cause of action. And it's an emergency, it's an urgent situation with medical care to civilians and combatants in complete disarray. So I prepared the petition and submitted it.
Why is the Organization of American States the only place you can go with this?
The United States has ratified no international human rights agreements that has in it a right for persons who feel they have been violated by the United States to file. We've signed and ratified a number of human rights agreements, but not those sections or portions of those that allow actions, actual actions, for human rights violations. I call it sort of defensive ratification. The United States can say, oh, no, we're signatory parties, but any lawyer knows if you don't have a right of action under the treaty, you might as well not even have it out there. It's just sweet-smelling words. However, the Organization of American States has a provision in its charter that requires all member states to accept the jurisdiction of the Inter-American Commission on Human Rights. You can't opt out. So that's the only human rights forum we can go to. You can't opt out.
And has that body pursued petitions like yours in the past?
Well, my Grenada petition, yes, it accepted it. The United States built a $4.2 million state-of-the-art facility to replace the one they bombed.
Okay, so you have had success at this before.
Yes. The one issue here is that the action did not occur in the territory of a member state of the Organization of American States, whereas the Grenada petition was filed, the victims were in this hemisphere. So in a sense, this is a test case, although similar cases brought at the parallel body at the Council of Europe, the European Court of Human Rights, have not found any limitation as to who the victims are, only that you can only petition against a member of the Council of Europe. And in my review of all the language of the OAS Charter and the American Declaration of Rights and Duties of Man, which is the human rights instrument that we use at the OAS, there's absolutely nothing in there that says petitions can only be brought by residents of member states of the OAS. It does say that organizational petitioners who are filing on behalf of actual victims have to be under the domestic statute of a member state of the OAS, and both AHL and HLP are United States private nonprofits.
So have you yourself had any contact with the victims of which you are representing here?
I have, directly and indirectly. In the Organization of American States proceedings, a non-governmental organization or an organizational petitioner with a nexus to victims can file without named victims. That's why the petition was originally named Unnamed, Unnumbered Persons, both living and dead at the facilities. And our nexus is that we specifically specialize in armed conflict law. That's what humanitarian law is. It's actually armed conflict law. It's a bit of a misnomer in a sense, although it's called humanitarian law because the very purpose of the Geneva Conventions in the first place was to protect medical facilities in time of war. That was the whole raison d'etre. That was the whole purpose behind setting up the Red Cross system in the first place. Battlefield medical care, bottom line. And from that, of course, a number of other rules have evolved, such as, you know, limitations on military operations and weaponry and the like. But the basis for humanitarian law is medical aid for victims of armed conflict on either side, combatant, non-combatant, civilian, enemy, non-enemy. So the Humanitarian Law Project and Association of Humanitarian Lawyers have a very strong interest. Their whole point, their whole purpose of being is this area of law. So we're particularly unique in that most human rights organizations don't have that focus and may not be viewed as having sufficient nexus. Now, as we find out actual victims, the names, the actual names of people who were killed or injured, we are adding them as provisional named petitioners pending their approval or notification of next of kin. It's still an emergency basis because, you know, there were 7 or 8 health personnel that we know by name that were killed in the attack on one of the clinics. Their families are so dispersed and the situation in Fallujah is so in chaos, the likelihood of our getting permission from next of kin, so to speak, is very slim, at least until the emergency is long gone. So we're convinced that the OAS will allow them as provisional named petitioners. I'm also in contact with a number of people on the ground. One of them is Dar. I think you know who Dar is. Mm-hmm. And others are medical doctors and or lawyers that I know through my long work in the situation in Iraq, several of whom are on the ground in various places. And they are tracking down doctors who know and trying to get some sense of the numbers. But at this point, I think it's going to be some time till we really know the numbers. We also don't know what the condition is of patients who had been in Fallujah General Hospital that were obviously not made any better by what went on. And so tracking down how this made them worse. Of course, now it's made them worse because there's no food and there's no water. And apparently the director of Fallujah General Hospital had gone to try to get some supplies, came back from Baghdad in an ambulance, and that ambulance was shot at and he was wounded. That was several days ago. So it's chaos. It doesn't get any worse than this as far as violations go.
So can you summarize again how many people we're talking about for this particular incident?
Well, if it were in a U.S. court, it would be does. I'd probably put does 1 through 50,000. I just don't know. My guess is it's somewhere in the range of 4,000 to 5,000 people who were specifically damaged under the provisions of Geneva Convention that protects medical personnel, patients, clinics, the Red Crescent, the Red Cross, ambulances, facilities, storehouses of medical aid, etc.
So clarify for me, if this petition moves forward as you would like it to, what would be the next steps or phases that you would see happening in it?
One of the next steps is already occurring. When a petition goes in, normally the commissioners will send elements of it to the United States government and ask for a response. I think this is already happening, particularly because of the exigencies of the situation and because both the International Committee of the Red Cross and the United Nations High Commissioner for Human Rights have spoken out. That's an alert to the OAS that things are pretty bad. So that pressure coming into the United States from within the inter-American system, which would theoretically involve all the states in the Western Hemisphere that are members, and I think there are very few that aren't. Several are British colonies, so they're not in. But the Caribbean, Canada, Mexico, Central America, and South America. It's a pretty heavy haul when it comes to maintaining diplomatic clout. And that's one of the reasons we have the Inter-American Commission on Human Rights, so that one state just doesn't turn into a rogue elephant. So the United States is going to have to answer back, particularly because it's an urgent situation. The Organization of American States will issue privately to the United States measures that they feel must be taken right away. They're called provisional measures. The United States can't make things worse, has to protect all potential claimants, that kind of thing. We won't know directly what has been ordered, but we may be able to guess based on what happens in the field. If suddenly the United States sets up a field hospital for the people who were in the clinics that are destroyed and in the hospitals that have been destroyed or dismantled, that would be an evidence that the pressure of the OAS on the United States has borne fruit.
And then what would be your ultimate goal in this?
The ultimate goal is for the Organization of American States to find the violations that we say have occurred. And in a sense, they already have, because they've assigned it a number. If they didn't think it was a violation, they could address it wouldn't be assigned a number, and we would be told, sorry, this is manifestly ill-founded. So in a sense, we've already found for the law. The next step is finding remedy, to the degree you can get remedy. Now, a lot of people say, but nothing makes up for. Well, this is true. That's why we have lawsuits to try to make up for it. That's why personal injury damages now are upwards of $2 and $3 million a person. Nothing makes up for it. But the way of making it hurt the violator is to pay up. So we, of course, want the medical facilities in Fallujah to look gleaming state-of-the-art with everything they could possibly need. And we want monetary compensation for victims, whether living or dead. If dead, paid to next of kin. If living, whatever their costs are, plus punitive damages because it's war crimes. If what the United States has to do doesn't hurt, then it's sort of like apologizing for a war crime and say, oh yeah, well, you know, fix it up a little bit. So we want the remedy to hurt, both in terms of the strength of the condemnation and in terms of the dollar amount to victims. American people and our legislators have to know, if we're going to go to war, we have to know the rules of war. If we don't, and we violate the absolute basis for armed conflict law, then we have to learn our lesson.
In addition to the U.S. actions in Fallujah being a violation of the Geneva Convention, are they a violation of any U.S. laws?
They're a violation of all the human rights instruments that the United States has ever ratified. Arbitrary loss of life, violation of the right to health, right to food, right to water, right to subsistence. In fact, I have to frame the actual violations to the OAS in terms of the instruments directly under the OAS. Although the OAS can look in general at international law that relates, in a curious sense, the Geneva Conventions end up being what the United States would have to argue as a defense, which of course they can't because they violated the Geneva Conventions. So the Geneva Convention might excuse a loss of life if it were legitimate, what they call collateral damage. You can't have legitimate collateral damage excuse when you've attacked something that's off limits. But say there was a military base, and the United States fired in the military base, and civilian people who do the laundry were coming in with their laundry truck, and they get hit. That's a loss of life, but the Organization of American States will not call it an actionable loss of life because the United States was legally entitled to fire on that military base and that there might have been some civilians around doesn't turn it into a civilian target.
The current administration has made some claims with calling things part of the war on terror and that certain parts of the Geneva Convention don't apply to us because of this special war on terror.
Well, that's a total bogus. I'm appalled that members of Congress aren't speaking out on this. All I can conclude is none of them know armed conflict law, and they're putting themselves, their constituents, and their country in huge, huge disadvantage by not even being able to tell a war from a not war. They can't tell the difference between a war and terrorism. People fighting an occupying force are combatants in a war of self-determination, whether you like it or not, whether you like them or not. The United States is an occupying power in a sovereign state, and people have a right to resist an occupying force. And that resistance is governed, of course, by armed conflict law, the Geneva Conventions, the Hague Conventions, all the rules of armed conflict. We're using tanks and soldiers. You know, terrorists are terrorists because they can't carry out military operations. They don't have an army. They're whatever. You don't fight someone whose weapons are airplanes running into buildings with an army. You don't know where they are, even. I mean, you fight terrorism by trying to find the terrorists. You don't fight terrorism by tanks roaming through a foreign country that had nothing to do with terrorism in the United States anyway. And when the people resist, that's not terrorism. That's spontaneous uprising. The usual term in armed conflict law is levée en masse. But it's gone actually beyond levée en masse because the opposition, or sometimes the United States calls them insurgent forces when they don't say terrorists. The insurgent forces are getting more and more organized. They're carrying out organized actions. That said, it does not mean that there aren't acts of terrorism occurring in Iraq by all parties. Setting a bomb off in a civilian marketplace is an act of terrorism in armed conflict, and that's also prohibited by the Geneva Conventions. But people also have to understand that from the perspective of armed conflict law, the military forces of the occupying power and the, it would be called, I suppose, a quisling government, a government we installed, the military forces and police forces acting as military forces are targets. They're legal military targets. That's who you can target. You can't target the hospital. You can't target the market. You can't target the school. You can't target the mosque.
So what has been the reaction so far of your petition?
Well, it's gaining momentum as far as media attention of groups that are opposed to the war or appalled at what's going on, the Veterans for Peace. There's so many organizations, but the Organization of Soldiers Returned from Iraq, which are ones you want to get. I mean, I want to have veterans organizations knowledgeable about this situation because they have connections with the soldiers, and it's the soldiers who ultimately have to refuse these orders. So when they see what it really means to attack a hospital, they know if they're ordered to attack a hospital, they should say, "No, sir, I'm not allowed to do that, sir, under the Geneva Convention, Article 51, sir." An individual soldier isn't going to do that, but a platoon might. And so it's most important that the military groups are on to this, and they're increasingly on. I think all the ones that I know about it or posting it or writing about it, contacting me. What is really distressing is members of Congress who are presumed to know. They're charged with knowing, and at the degree of violation, I mean, these are grave breaches. This is war crimes of the highest degree. Their silence can be viewed as complicity. And it's amazing to me why the Democrats haven't spoken out about war crimes. I mean, it's grounds for impeachment. As I say, it doesn't get worse than this.
So what would you like listeners to do?
Well, I would certainly urge listeners to write letters to the editor and wherever they're listening and let people know what the United States has done in Fallujah to the medical facilities, the clinics, the personnel, the patients, is a war crime. is a grave breach of the Geneva Conventions. It's called wanton loss of life and destruction unwarranted by military necessity. There's no military necessity in a hospital. You don't even come close to that excuse. And, you know, just inform the American public and the cost to them, not only in world public opinion, but in their pocketbook. And also I would encourage listeners to notify their members of Congress and ask why they haven't spoken up. It's a war crime. Are they aware of the petition? It's certainly been out there. Groups have been calling their members of Congress. I haven't heard one speak up yet, which is shocking. And I know they've seen the pictures. The picture that was in San Francisco paper had been in the New York Times. But we're a country at war. Our legislators have to know the rules of war. If they don't know the rules of war and are letting the State Department and the Defense Department determine what they are and then sort of brief them, that's dereliction of duty. If we're going to go to war, we better know the rules of war, because we're putting ourselves as a government, obviously, in financial jeopardy with successful lawsuits, but we're also training a military that commits war crimes. One of the serious issues for the United States is when these soldiers come back, they're walking time bombs. You don't engage in this type of operation without serious difficulty unless you're already a psychopath. Now, I've seen photographs of U.S. tanks with corpses with their hands tied behind their back. What risk were they if their hands are tied behind their back? Clearly dead, and they're hung on tanks. They're hanging bodies that they kill on tanks and gloating and parading around with them. That in itself is a war crime, by the way. You can't desecrate corpses. In fact, you're supposed to seek out and find the dead and help notify the next of kin or allow the International Committee of the Red Cross or other Red Cross personnel from the local Red Cross to identify the bodies and locate next of kin. It's been more than 2 weeks, and there are bodies still rotting in the streets, being eaten by dogs. There are dead bodies hanging well, I'm sure when they start smelling, they'll find another body to put on the tanks. But this kind of depravity, this is worse than the torture, and it's affecting far more people. This is worse than the torture in Al-Gharab, in the jails. These are whole platoons, large numbers of U.S. forces, either seeing these acts happening, participating in them, not trying to stop them. I mean, there were a lot of people who stormed Fallujah General Hospital. There are a lot of people out there in those tanks roaming the streets and shooting at sight, shooting up ambulances. The psychological problems for those that aren't already psychopaths are going to haunt us and all of us. They're certainly going to haunt their families and their communities, their children. And imagine if your child, who might be 2 now, when 18 and they've actually studied the Iraq War, say, Dad or Mom, did you do any of that? Very, very serious to do that to our men. We've infected our fighting men. We've ordered them to carry out war crimes, and nobody really does that lightly.
Can the individuals on the U.S. side that do participate in war crimes, can they individually be held accountable from, let's say, the soldiers in the field that carry these out all the way up the chain of command?
Yes, although it's preferable to get the person ordering rather than the lowdown. But superior orders is no defense. That's the international law term. Superior orders is no defense. However, all the high contracting parties to the Geneva Conventions have an obligation or a duty to seek out violators and try them in their national courts, if possible. The reason there's the International Criminal Court is a lot of countries were hesitant of having trials in their own countries, so they sort of established a neutral body, so they wouldn't have to involve themselves in the politics of things. But the Geneva Conventions do require all countries to seek out and try violators. My guess is that people seeking out and trying violators are going to be more interested in the commanders than our forces in the field. But it doesn't mean that some American GI who decides to take a trip to Paris and someone recognizes him or he or she identifies themselves or maybe even wears a uniform and name is on it or something, couldn't be tried. We think, however, the best place to try to get actual remedies for victims is at the Organization of American States. There are other places you can go to try to punish the violator, including our own courts. We should have courts martial for anyone who ordered or carried out these operations, particularly those who ordered them. But my organizations are more interested in, first of all, preventing these types of war crimes by information, education on how war should be fought, what's off limits, what isn't off limits, etc. But our real focus is victims, not punish the violator. So this is a lawsuit for the victims. Yes, the violator should be punished vis-a-vis paying for it, but this is not a criminal proceeding against the specific violators. It's against the country for doing it.
How can people find out more about your petition and your organization?
Well, a Humanitarian Law Project has a website. I think if you go into the computer, you can put in humanitarianlawproject.org, and I think it pops up, even though I think it has home, HLP, there's no www, but hlp.home.igc.org. People can email at ied@igc.org. And for people who are in a position to do so, we desperately need funds to continue. I should have said that before I said they should talk to their member of Congress. Anyone out there that's got a pocket a little bit deeper than others, you know, if they could contribute, would be very helpful.
Can they do that through your website, or?
No, our organizations are actually too poor to have all the sophisticated stuff on the website. But people can send checks either to me, Karen Parker, or to Association of Humanitarian Lawyers, 154 Fifth Avenue, San Francisco, 94118. That would be the same address for me because, you know, I'm the president of it. So I use my office as also the office of HLP. For those who are in the Northwest, they can contact Karen Ahern, K-L-A-H-E-R-N, at MSN.com, and she will direct people how best to contribute monetarily as well as further assistance with media and legislators. She's been our volunteer outreach person.
All right. Any final thoughts you'd like to share with listeners?
I hope this is the last time that American forces are involved in a war of this nature, and the last time that American forces are ordered to carry out this kind of action. I just can't say it strongly enough or more often. There's really nothing much to say. I mean, these events make you speechless. It doesn't get any worse than this, and we have got to own up to it.
Well, I want to thank you for spending time with us today.
You're welcome.